In the last half of our program this morning, we'll be looking back at the contributions of our friend and comrade Todd Sloan. We'll be looking at the contributions specifically that he made to our program and to social justice organizing. He was a frequent contributor to The Old Mole on the Psychology and Politics series with Jan Hocken, and Jan joins me for this memorial tribute.
Todd Sloan, professor of psychology, author, and activist, and a dear friend, died last week from pancreatic cancer. Todd was a frequent contributor to The Old Mole and a guiding force behind a number of social justice projects in Portland and internationally. His books include Life Choices, Understanding Dilemmas and Decisions, Damaged Life, The Crisis of the Modern Psyche, and Critical Psychology, Voices for Change. Todd and I shared a love for left traditions in psychology, including feminist psychoanalysis and critical psychology. And we tried to enlist these theories to think through psychological dilemmas in social movements. Before he died on December 17th, Todd had recently returned from a conference in Chile on community psychology and social transformation, and another conference in New York City on psychology and capitalism. Todd's activism began with anti-nuclear and Central American solidarity work in the 1980s, then Green Party organizing in the 1990s, and anti-war organizing post 9/11. After moving to Portland in 2004, he worked with local sustainability projects, Tryon Life Community Farm and Transition Portland, as well as the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. Todd was a co-founder of the Social Justice Action Center, which grew from his vision of creating spaces where activists could reflect on their work and experiment with collective practices, forms of prefigurative politics, ways of realizing or practicing a vision of the world that can't yet be fully realized. He was known for dialogue methods he brought to social justice projects and what he termed, quote, supporting activists for the long haul.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Over the past few years, Todd Sloan made regular contributions to The Old Mole. Todd, along with Jan Hocken, developed this Psychology and Politics series covering a range of topics, including psychology and activism, psychology, torture, and the military, leftist psychology, emotion, envy, and inequality, and a review of the Netflix series House of Cards. Jan and I read now from dialogues over this past year following the election of Trump and the surge of activism in the U.S. This brief exchange speaks to the underlying principles in Todd's work, supporting activists for the long haul.
Mass movements, like the struggles of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, second wave feminism, and anti-war movements of the 1970s, bring groups together in ways that stir possibilities for radical social change, but they also generate their own anxieties. Sometimes periods of mobilization stir hope, but they can also set people up for disappointment. You've written about supporting activists for the long haul. What do you think is required?
There is a sort of community practice, a way of getting the work done among left activists that is passed from generation to generation. But this knowledge is not transmitted easily. each individual has to learn firsthand how to be part of a political community. When we have larger or broader movements, different communities of practice clash. For example, some activists bring business models, others nonprofit organizations, others non-hierarchical anarchist collective model, etc. Group conveners need to spend plenty of time helping a group know how it will process issues, make decisions, authorize action. And we should not be surprised or frightened when these communities of practice collide.
Well, how do we think then about the shifting emotional states of activism in a period of high hopes for mass mobilization, like the period we're living in now, when an intense climate of fear brings possibilities for radical change as well? There can be a bipolar aspect to activism.
There is a roller coaster in a complicated mess of feelings to sort out: anger, fear, despair, solidarity, courage, hopelessness, betrayal, guilt. What I worry about most is the post-anger and post-mobilization phase, in which there is still as much work to be done, but it is not as exciting, not as motivating. Movements require a lot of work to sustain themselves, and not all of that work is exciting. But there is pleasure in the daily work of movements as well. It's important to be deeply committed to dialogue, to be as fully dialogical as possible with good facilitation, so everyone feels heard and is actually heard. And sometimes managing the disturbing feelings that arise in groups can't be addressed by the group. Groups need to acknowledge their limits and what is to be done outside the primary group. That's why I have been forming activist support groups, forms of self-care, buddy systems, and mentoring relationships.
Melted furnace. Unexpectedly, we watched with faces hidden as the walls were tightening. As the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain dissolved into the bells of the lightning, tolling for the rebel, tolling for the rake, tolling for the luckless, they are abandoned and forsake, tolling for the outcast, burning constantly at stake. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
From a blog posted earlier this year, Todd describes his interest in the psychology of coloniality, an area of political psychology and critical theory that Todd took up before his death. He'd been particularly influenced by the work of Anibal Quijano, a Peruvian sociologist who developed the concept of coloniality. Quijano also died this year. Here is from Todd's blog post. Quote, "My studies continue to be exciting and a bit depressing. The history of European oppression and violence over the last 500 years is hard to wrap one's mind around for lots of reasons. How can people treat other humans so horribly? What is the source of this incredible greed shown by the Spaniards and English in particular? How did the former English colonies that became the United States take up this horrible role in the global scene? Slavery of Africans, genocide of Native Americans, imperialistic wars, and interventions in countries and governments around the world. I'm just trying to put together more pieces of the puzzle than I've had a chance to before, given that my focus was on personality theory and not on history."
Through the mad, mystic hammering of the wild, ripping hail, the sky cracked its palms in naked wonder at the clinging of the church bells, blew far into the breeze, leaving only bells of lightning and its thunder. striking for the gentle, striking for the kind, striking for the guardians and protectors of the mind, and the poet and the painter far behind his rightful time. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Last summer, Todd was having dinner with my partner and me, and we got to talking about depression and left politics. Both Todd and I, as critical psychologists, were not too keen on psychiatric diagnoses. We had a fondness for old 19th century terms for madness. Terms like idéfixé, monomania, neurasthenia, and melancholia. There's actually been a robust revival of interest in melancholia in cultural studies, some drawing on Freud's work, Mourning and Melancholia. Todd described himself as more melancholic than depressive, because melancholia means that you have experienced forms of goodness, taken in what we psychoanalysts call the good objects, but that you continue to suffer from losses that have been hard to get over. Melancholics are trying to recuperate the lost good objects amidst the bad in the world. Melancholia is a condition of longing, of striving, and I think for Todd, his revolutionary spirit carried that note of melancholic sadness into the struggle. Todd played a song for us that night titled Reflections of My Life. He'd been working out the chords on the song for some time, and he explained that this song expresses quite profoundly the state of melancholia in reflecting on the life of this dear friend and comrade, Todd Sloan. I would like to play that song now.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, KBOO FM 90.7. We're spending some time this morning memorializing our friend and comrade Todd Sloan, who died on December 17th. We miss him, and we'd like to continue to share his contributions. Let me first say that I personally met Todd in 2004 when he first moved to Portland, and my first thought was, you know, who is this quiet man with such a great speaking voice? We really need to get him on the Old Mole, and I mean that. It did take a little bit of time to get him settled in to the idea of coming on the radio, but he eventually became an important voice for socialist struggle through his work in critical psychology. Now, we'd like to turn to a piece that he did on psychology and activism. It was Psychological Effects of Oppression. Todd Sloan.
Welcome to another episode in our ongoing series on the psychology of activism. Organizers working for social justice often wonder why people who are sufficiently informed about issues that affect them in major ways do not immediately act and work for social change. There are, of course, many obstacles like lack of time, need for childcare, work schedules, lack of understanding of social movements, and so forth. Because of these things, many of us limit our activism to sending a check, signing a petition, or clicking like on Facebook, and hoping that such acts will pile up and make a difference. There are, however, what might be called psychological obstacles to action, and these are more complicated than simple fear of retaliation, or laziness, or procrastination. These psychological obstacles are embedded in our character structures and defense mechanisms as a result of experiencing domination, oppression, marginalization, and exclusion. This means it should be fruitful to turn to psychoanalysis, the science of unconscious psychological processes. We could ask, for example, what can psychoanalysts tell us about the ways in which we are shaped psychologically by the various forms of oppression that we experience as we are growing up and living out in our adult lives? And how would understanding these effects of oppression inform practices such as consciousness raising, community organizing, and mobilization efforts for social and environmental justice? These questions were actually the topic of a workshop at a recent meeting of the Association for the Psychoanalysis of Culture and Society at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Most of the participants in the workshop were psychotherapists or psychoanalysts with a few academics in the human sciences. I personally found the discussion especially relevant to our efforts as organizers struggling to mobilize people to participate in progressive social movements, so I share some general conclusions here. First of all, by oppression, we had in mind constraints and subjection that people experience as members of a group due to marginalization, exclusion, discrimination, structural violence such as poverty, and direct violence. This would include, of course, sexism, racism, homophobia, classism, as well as ableism, ageism, and other less recognized forms of oppression. How do these experiences of oppression leave their traces in the structure and functioning of the psyche? We usually tend to gloss over the complexities here with simple references to, for example, trauma or complexes, or abstract terms like alienation or marginalization. We also tend to lump together all sorts of oppression and violence and domination. These are obviously not the same. But to illustrate what the workshop discussed, we'll focus on oppression related to classism, in particular the ways in which the psyche is shaped by experiences of class oppression, rendering workers less capable of recognizing exploitation at work and less likely to join with others to change working conditions, for example, by having the courage to unionize or to go on strike. This is obviously not a case of blockage due to a one-time traumatic experience, although there may be exemplary experiences of violence in individual lives, such as bullying or parental abuse, that might be organized along class lines. The effects of classism over one's life settle into clusters of memories and experiences that generate interpretations of oneself in relation to powerful or privileged others as inadequate, weak, isolated, different, shameful, humiliated, embarrassed, etc. These experiences might occur at home with authoritarian parents, or at school with teachers prone to shaming less prepared students, or on the playground, or in the neighborhood where many forms of cruelty are practiced, or in the city where differences of wealth are obvious while shopping or just walking around. They could also be related to the media, where lower socioeconomic classes are portrayed in stereotyped ways, or are simply absent from most programming. The memories and self-images linked to these experiences coalesce into a generalized psychological stance that is activated when one finds oneself in social scenarios where class position, status, economic power are in play. For example, in a personal meeting with the boss, a meeting of workers with management, a meeting of renters and landlords. In some cases, the psychological stance may lead to resistance, revolt, or sabotage, for example. But what we mostly need to understand better are the stances that get labeled as apathy, passivity, dejection, submission, withdrawal, and bystanding while others experience oppression more directly. How can we best understand these limiting psychological stances? First, we can notice that as a result of experiences of class oppression, the psychic structure may be characterized by things like constraints on imagination and agency, because there are prohibitions on expression, expansiveness, and creativity. There might be rigid identifications with dominant ideas or authority figures, and little freedom for exploration of negative feelings that might develop into a more critical and questioning attitude. There might be self-evaluations that are either idealized or denigrated as inferior, and in general, a lack of congruence between thought, feeling, and action. Second, we should also develop a concept of how the psyche might be structured if these experiences of class or other oppressions were not frequent, pervasive, or eventually powerful as they accumulate over time. One would find instead greater freedom of play between impulses, desires, sensations, and imagination and memories, greater agency and capacity for connection and relationship, congruence of thought, feeling, and action, fuller and more complex meaning-making, deep awareness of and stronger responses to acts of oppression that are occurring in the present. Now, when we turn to what practices of organizing should take into account in light of this, we need to keep in mind that the primary tasks are to enhance a person's capacity to make sense of what is going on, both emotionally and relationally, to articulate experiences to give voice to their suffering, to feel recognized and heard by others, and to develop trust and solidarity with a group of others who are also affected or acting in alliance with one's group. It's also important to remember, finally, that organizing practices that support the overcoming of psychological effects of oppression go far beyond simple education and information. Ideally, they mobilize the senses and the body through the arts, music, poetry, spirituality, dance, and connection to the rest of nature. They should also be deeply dialogical in order to ensure time to listen and understand what all have been experiencing and to foster visions of better futures. These are the sorts of practices that can address and overcome the psychological effects of oppression. This is Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
That's Tracy Chapman talking about a revolution. Todd Sloan was very fond of music, spoke quite a bit with our old mole Tom Becker about music. They were both great lovers of music and poetry and writing and philosophy, all of it. And I want to thank Tom for compiling the music for this tribute this morning. We also heard Reflections of My Life by Marmalade, Scottish band, 1968. A very wonderful piece of music as well. Bob Dylan, Chimes of Freedom. Thanks, Tom, for those. I want to also thank Jan Hawken and Joe Clement for helping produce this memorial tribute. I also want to, on behalf of the Old Mole, the Radio Collective, I want to make sure that we send out our love and well wishes to the family and friends who made up Todd Sloan's community here in Portland and around the world. Todd, you will certainly be missed.